This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. For the past 3 years, the Body Island Lighthouse on the Outer Banks has undergone significant renovations, and for the first time, it will be open to the public in late spring. Stephen O'Connell talked with historian and cultural resources manager for the Outer Banks Group, Douglas Stover, about the renovations and the history of the lighthouse.
Well, I tell you, after 5 years of working on this project, we are at a point now where we're finally seeing the end of the tunnel on this project. I mean, it is, by looking at that lighthouse now, I mean, it almost looks like it was when it was first built. So,
when was it first built?
Well, it was built in pretty much 1871. And of course, this is the third Body Island lighthouse where the first one actually collapsed during shortly after construction. The second one was attempted to be blown up during the Civil War. So,
is there anything different about the lighthouse now that it's been restored?
I think what makes this restoration and this lighthouse so special, particularly on Outer Banks, is two things. One, it's a lighthouse that the public has never experienced climbing before. It's always been closed. Number two is, I think, because of the view shed. If you climb that lighthouse today, I mean, that lighthouse, the view of that lighthouse from the top of the balcony, where you actually see almost the same view as you would if the keepers were there back in 1871. That's what the public is really going to experience, is the beautiful view shed. So,
Mr. Stover, would you elaborate on some of the most significant renovations done?
Yeah, as you know, this lighthouse during its restoration has had quite a bit of challenges. As we began the first restoration 3 years ago, we ran into very serious structural problems. The problem was that the paint was covering up a lot of cracks in pretty much the brickwork, as well as some of the metalwork. You figure it's probably had approximately probably 10 layers of paint put on. So it was covering up and actually sealing a lot of the cracks. So when we removed the paint, a lot of it was exposed, a lot of the cracks. So we had to actually come and look at, what did we need to do or change to make it safe enough for people to climb, as well as trying to keep as much of the historic fabric as possible. So that was a challenge. The other part of the challenge was that we wanted the public to have the experience of climbing this lighthouse, and so we had to come up with some additional structural beams to support the balcony. So, and I think we've come up with a design that, from the most public view, you wouldn't notice it. So, but I think the biggest challenge, and the first time it's ever actually been done, is that when we replaced the metal, which was a cast iron metal, when the lighthouse was built, and cast iron is very brittle iron that actually will crack, will also salt will get to it and pretty much decompose it quickly. What we did was we decided to go ahead, and I call it the greening of the lighthouse, is where we actually took the metal down, we actually recycled and melted the original cast iron, added some other metals to it to strengthen it, recast it, and put it back. So the first time we went ahead and recycled historic properties.
Who's been doing the work for these past 5 years?
The project was contracted out. A lot of it was contracted with local contractors throughout eastern North Carolina. Matter of fact, the Lumbee tribe here in North Carolina were the contractors that actually painted the lighthouse. That tribe is actually located just near the border of North Carolina and South Carolina, down in Fayetteville. They're the ones that bidded for it. So it was made up of, Native Americans from North Carolina that actually painted it.
Huh. And will the lighthouse be put back in service? Actually?
It will. Our next step is to begin the final inspection, where we'll actually kind of do a punch list, look at small items that need to be done, and we're hoping to have that complete within next month. And then our next step is to go in and put the lens back in.
Tell me about the lens.
It's a first-order lens. It's the largest of all lighthouse lenses. And what makes it special is because all lighthouses in North Carolina and most of the United States are owned and operated by the U.S. Coast Guard as active navigational aid. What makes this lens a little bit special is because in 2003, the U.S. Coast Guard transferred not just the lighthouse, but it's also the navigational aid. So the National Park Service maintains and manages that light. And on the new U.S. Coast Guard property, the Coast Guard is trying to remove a lot of lenses to bring more modern devices to the lighthouses, which is going to require removing a lot of lenses. And our goal is for the next generation is for people to experience of looking at a lens inside a lighthouse.
And when will it be open for the public?
Well, we're looking at trying to look at sometime this late spring. So at this time, we're actually looking at trying to have a relighting ceremony, and we're actually under plans now of doing that. So.
I appreciate you speaking with me.
Thank you.
If you read magazines or watch television, you might guess the holiday season is a cheerful time of the year, but it's not for all. L.C. Morris has more.
As yet another holiday season comes to an end, some people are left feeling down about expectations they put on themselves. For those who loathe what otherwise would be a joyous time, the term holiday depression seems to be the best way to describe it. But is it a real thing? Dr. Bryce Kay, a psychologist and therapist, says holiday depression is psychological.
You can go into a state of real down moods of grief, for instance, for a day or two, and then bounce right back up. And very often that's what's happening around the holidays.
Kay has a practice in New Bern and Cary, North Carolina.
The undercurrent of a lot of depressed feelings at Christmas time is the secret hopes that people tried to stamp out because they were too frustrating, but they were unsuccessful in stamping them out, and now they feel the pain.
Dr. Kay says people deal with emotions differently, and depression during this time of year can be interesting.
Some sense that what's going on is that they don't have the sense of family closeness that everybody else seems to be having on the media or seems to be looking forward to. Or this is a time when the alcoholic father shot the family dog. And all of these contrasts of how life was so cruel tends to pop up. You get a lot of sadness about what hasn't been able to happen. You can be hurt by things that happen, but you can be hurt by things that don't happen. At Christmas time, the holidays, people get sad about what never happened.
How do you get sad about something that never happened?
Because you still secretly long for it. And because you don't really admit it to yourself, your brain has to do this battle of kind of fighting it back because you've learned to try to kill that hope because it hurts too much to really hope for that close bond with mom or dad or family. It hurts too much if you let yourself be aware of it, and so you just try to stamp it out because you try to tell yourself that you gave up on it. But then parts of you really didn't. And those parts get aggravated around Christmas time.
Holding back how you feel or bursting at the tip of the tongue is how holiday dinner arguments are born, among other things.
We are masters at what's known as counteraction. For instance, if we're afraid of being a certain way very often will do the opposite. You know, a person is afraid that they're a coward. They're afraid that their soldier mates are going to see their cowardice. So what do? They're the ones who charge machine guns nests and get killed. So we are masters at trying to prove the opposite.
Acknowledgement of the pain and handling it can go in either direction, taking a step back and evaluating yourself, or
you can distract yourself, maybe, or try to distract yourself by getting angry and becoming outraged, and that gives you a sense of being strong, you see. So if instead of feeling weak and rejected and unloved, you can feel strong by finding something to pick on on somebody around you, and if you rage at them momentarily, you feel strong instead of weak. So it can knock us off balance.
When these bouts of longing or frustration of not being loved or noticed around the holidays grace you with thunderous charge, be mindful to take care of yourself.
Stop fighting yourself. If you have old frustrations, old hurts of what your family wasn't, what did not exist, that you long for, finding a love, using your own relationship and talking to your partner about the pain. And so instead of trying to deny it, giving the sadness a place helps to remove some of the pressure. Now, you don't want to wallow in it.
Holiday depression is not to be confused with clinical depression. That's when emptiness and despair take hold and won't go away.
That's when your serotonin levels or your dopamine levels become depleted in the synapses of your brain, and you'll get all sorts of what we call vegetative symptoms. For instance, loss of appetite, loss of sleep. Actually, you can get a slowdown of motor speed. The person starts moving very slowly when profoundly depressed. You get distortions in judgment. You may get suicidal ideation. In severe cases, you get hallucinations, loss of appetite, loss of weight, loss of energy, concentration goes. And all those are vegetative signs of a biological imbalance.
Dr. K says seek medical help if you are experiencing the motions. If you recognize symptoms in a loved one, don't hesitate to seek out help. The USA National Suicide Hotlines are open 24 hours a day. You can call 1-800-SUICIDE, that's 1-800-784-2433, or 1-800-273-TALK.
When you don't have to fight against the truth, your mind is more free to embrace joy. That's the bottom line.
I'm L.C. Morris.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Winston Churchill is believed the source for the observation that history is written by the victors. The life and subsequent disappearance from history of a North Carolina-born slave and abolitionist illustrates the truth behind that remark. George Olson has more.
David Soselsky is a historian of some note in the state, a Craven County native who was taught at Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and ECU. He's the author or editor of several books examining the history of the eastern region of the state, including works on the 1898 Wilmington race riots and maritime culture during the slave era. He is someone well-versed in the history of this region, which made his initial discovery of the subject of his latest book quite a surprise.
I have really devoted my life as a historian to telling the stories of eastern North Carolina. And while doing research for other books, I kept coming across this mysterious figure, Abraham Galloway, who I had never heard of, going behind enemy lines to rescue his mother from slavery during the war, and you know, a dozen other stories that made him seem like this larger-than-life, very mysterious and very exciting individual, but I had no idea who he was.
Galloway may be known to some degree in the state as one of the first African Americans in the state legislature. He was one of three elected in 1868, serving a single term. But in Soselsky's opinion, and as laid out in his new book, The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, Galloway was much more than just a political first in North Carolina history.
Only in time, as I did more and more research, did I come to understand that Galloway was really a national figure and probably the most important African-American figure in the American South during the Civil War. But that was actually late in my research, as I followed him to sort of a now famous meeting with Abraham Lincoln and touring the North as a spokesman for African-American politics during the war.
Galloway went from slave to elected representative in a relatively short time, a slave in 1857, a state senator in 1868, made possible by the leap Galloway took when he made the decision to escape his servitude. David Soselsky reads from The Fire of Freedom.
In early 1857, young Abraham Galloway vowed to depart the world of his childhood. At 20 years old, he had lived by the banks of the Cape Fear River all his life and had never traveled more than a day's journey from his friends and family in Smithville and Wilmington. But that spring, he and a friend grew determined, they later explained, that liberty was worth dying for and that it was their duty to strike for freedom, even if it should cost them their lives.
Galloway made the decision to leave despite having, for a slave, a relatively good life. A brick mason, he could choose his jobs as long as most of the money went to his owner, and this afforded him some bit of freedom that slaves working in a field did not enjoy. But still he left, perhaps a product of an oddity in the South at the time. His father was a white waterman, John Galloway, who, unlike most births involving free white men and enslaved black women, actually acknowledged his son with the slave Hester Hankins.
Said, "This is my son," and Abraham always said later that his father did everything he could to look after him. That had limits, of course, because he wasn't his owner. But all his life, Abraham Galloway spoke well of his father and acknowledged both sides of his heritage. And I do believe that later, as Abraham Galloway becomes such an important political figure, Abraham always went out of his way to bring together blacks and whites in political coalitions. And I think that was partly because of his family roots.
John Galloway was known as charismatic, courageous, and quick-tempered, which were probably descriptors also used to describe his son Abraham, who, after escaping from the South, returned to the South to work as a spy for the Union Army as he joined the fight against the Confederacy. But Soselsky says as fervently as Galloway fought to destroy the Confederacy, he often fought the Union Army for its treatment of slaves it encountered as it moved through the South.
And the second thing that Galloway saw down in Mississippi was the Union Army promised somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 slaves their freedom if they would help dig a vitally important canal to go around Vicksburg. That did not work, like from an engineering point of view, and the Union Army retreated. And when they retreated, they left those slaves there. So you can imagine their fate. You can imagine how slaveholders in Mississippi would treat those African-American men and women. These were not things that a man like Abraham Galloway would quickly forgive or forget, and he didn't.
What Abraham Galloway experienced is also telling of the slave population of the time. The typical discussion of the Civil War centers around momentous battles between North and South, but David Soselsky says lost in the retelling of the war is another side, with Abraham Galloway as one of its leaders, that attempted to exert its influence on the outcome.
As I did the research for the book, I really began to see there's the North and the South, the Union and the Confederacy, but then there's them. And I really began to see the African Americans of the South as a third force, always determined to destroy the Confederacy, but also wary of the Union in many ways and with their own agenda oriented towards slave liberation.
It was perhaps what Galloway saw in the service of the Union that brought him to an interesting insight on how liberation may be found. It was to be found, not necessarily through social equality, but with access to the ballot box. David Soselsky reads from The Fire of Freedom about an address Galloway gives in 1864 at what is now St. Peter AME Zion Church in New Bern.
At Andrew Chapel, he made clear that he understood that his audience yearned for more than voting rights. He realized that those gathered there still felt the stings of 100 daily reminders of their oppression. Local customs decreed, among much else, that black men and women stepped aside for all white pedestrians, waited in line behind all white customers at stores, sat on the exposed lower decks of steamships, and never shared a dining room with whites. Galloway understood all too well how much the former slaves resented these enduring signs of racial prejudice and hostility. His revolutionary agenda included pushing aside those relics of slavery, but he insisted that they first and foremost stay fixed on voting rights. As for social equality and racial segregation, Galloway told the church that he was willing, and this is a quote, to wait a little longer But as the Anglo-African's local correspondent quoted him, he wanted his political rights now. Though I should say, of course, that Galloway was notorious for not giving ground on sidewalks, for not conceding any indignity. But when it came to his political thinking, this was one of the most striking times where we see Galloway looking beyond the current moment to that distant future and saying, okay, we can accept some indignities now in exchange for this future vision of equality and political rights. And that was not at all a universal opinion among African-American leaders in the South or North at that time. But for Galloway, it was, if we can vote, everything else will follow.
The ballot box got Galloway into the state Senate in 1868, but in terms of everything else will follow, Galloway did not live long enough to shepherd that forward. He died suddenly in 1870 at the age of 33, a time when some of what blacks had won at the ballot box started to retrench and soon gave way to Jim Crow in the South. When Galloway died, it was reported that his funeral was the largest the state had seen up to that time. But soon Galloway was an ignored figure in state history, washed out by an historical narrative that Galloway's radical abolitionism did not fit neatly into.
He was a brilliant individual who really, I really consider one of the most important African-American figures in American history. But for 125 years, I'm sure that no school child ever uttered his name. Immediately after the war, of course, he wasn't forgotten, but in coming years, the South and the North, to some degree, created this almost mythical image of the Civil War. I guess we could call it sort of the Gone with the Wind version. And let's face it, it's hard to imagine Abraham Galloway, who wore two pistols at his hip, punched out Union naval officers, went behind enemy lines to rescue his mother, and would stop at nothing in the struggle for freedom. It's hard to imagine Abraham Galloway in Gone with the Wind.
David Soselsky is the author of The Fire of Freedom, Abraham Galloway and the Slave Civil War, published by UNC Press. I'm George Olson.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Each week I introduce myself to you as Horticulture Extension Agent. And I've started wondering, how many of you have any idea what that means? And how many of you are wondering every week what I'm referring to? Well, I work for North Carolina State University, and our office here in Carteret County is also supported with county funds. I work for the Cooperative Extension Service, and that is a part of the university that is designed to bring research-based information from the land-grant university, in this case, North Carolina State University, into each and every county of North Carolina. Yes, every county has an extension office. The number of staff and their specialties vary from county to county, usually based on the particular needs of that county, as well as funding. In our county, we have three extension agents and a program assistant. The general specialty areas for cooperative extension are agriculture, and that includes horticulture, whether it's commercial horticulture, farmers growing vegetables, or consumer horticulture, things like backyard gardens, commercial agriculture, which would be row crops or nurseries, any area where someone makes a living in growing plants of any kind. Family consumer science, well, that deals with those things that used to be called home economics. Healthy living, nutrition, financial management, all sorts of things fall under the family consumer science title. And then we have 4-H. 4-H is the youth branch of the Cooperative Extension Service and is designed to help young people develop not only particular knowledge and skills, but mostly to develop leadership skills. One of my favorite things in 4-H is the fact that youth who go through our programs learn how to do public speaking. And there's nothing more fun than watching someone very young, sometimes as young as 7 or 8 years old, stand up before an audience of adults and present a speech on a topic that they've researched and developed on their own. So my job is horticulture extension agent. I work with consumer horticulture, which can be lawns, gardens, nursery plants, and commercial agriculture. In our county, that's vegetable farmers and grain farmers. My background, I have a master's degree in agronomy. That's crop and soil science, for those of you who have never heard that term. Now, you can come to our office and pick up soil test boxes or ask questions about identifying insects or about how to grow various plants, including your vegetable garden. Children can take sewing classes and cooking classes and various summer programs, learn all sorts of advanced sciences. Or, if you don't want to come to our office, you can go on the web. Each county has its own website. So, think about your Cooperative Extension Service office and all the things that we can do for you. I'm Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.